Today is a good day already for a couple of reasons. One is that the Broncos won yesterday. Another is that we get to talk about Deuteronomy today. And that makes any day a good day. Any day you get to talk about Deuteronomy is a good day. So let's start with prayer, and then we'll get going. Father, thank you for the day. Thank you that the sun would rise again this morning. We remember with the rising of the sun that your mercy is new every morning. And we are so thankful for that. That we could wake up today with a clean slate in your eyes. And Father, as we are looking at the text this morning and thinking about what it means to live in a city and what your dream is for the city, I pray that you would give us wisdom, that you would give us an understanding of the text and an understanding of your will. And Father, we pray this in the name of Jesus. Amen. Amen. So for the last 5 weeks, we have been talking about the city, the theology of the city. What does the Bible say about cricket? What does the Bible say about cities? And so just to kind of recap where we've been so far, we talked about the four pillars of the city. We're defining what does it take for a community to be called a city. And the four pillars, anybody remember what they are?
Community.
Economy.
Industry.
Industry. And? Government. Got to have all four of those. Once you have all four of those, and in particular, I think once you have industry, because the first industry is government. Once you have all four of those, you have a city. The opposite of the city is not the small town. It's not a rural community. It's the wilderness. It's isolation from other people. Because once you have people that have banded together and they're producing food together, then you have a city. I guess maybe rural might qualify, but even then, if you live rural and you have a tractor, unless you built that tractor out of the iron that you mined yourself and forged in your own, like, you're doing business with the city. Okay. Cities breed pride. We talked about the dangers of the city, and the primary danger of living in a city is that cities foster pride, and they are forgetful. We become forgetful. We forget the good things that God has done for us. And we start to think that all of this is our own accomplishment, and we become kind of puffed up with our own ego. And so the way that that's mitigated is through an intentional remembering. And so Deuteronomy, which is where we talked about the dangers, gives these instructions for how to remember, that you would teach your kids the commands as when you get up in the morning, when you lie down, and when you are on the road, and when you are at home, and that you would put tassels on your garments to help you to remember, and that you would write the scriptures on your hands and on your forehead. So an intentional remembering is what gets you to not be proud. And then last week, we looked at how there is potential for good in the city. There's potential especially for people who are vulnerable and powerless. So specifically, we looked at a few different groups: widows, the fatherless, the poor, the foreigner. Where can people who don't have land to produce food for themselves, how are they going to survive? Where are they going to find resources? With the city. So there's potential for good. It's not inevitable. The good things, resources don't inevitably happen, but there's at least the potential for good in a city, particularly for people who are vulnerable. Okay. Any questions on any of that? Does that all sound familiar? We're doing okay? Okay. I appreciate the enthusiasm. All right. So, a couple of notes about Deuteronomy before we dive in. Because we're going to look at, first of all, what we're going to do today is look at the legislation in the book of Deuteronomy, which is a book of the law, and so it's not one that we spend a whole lot of time reading, but I think it's really important for us. We're going to look at what does Deuteronomy teach about the city. One reason for that is Deuteronomy is preparing Israel for an urban existence. We might read it like it's a list of rules. And I think for most of us, the way that we encounter Deuteronomy is you probably haven't done like a daily devotional through the book of Deuteronomy. You probably didn't wake up one day and say, I'm going to spend the next year reading through verse by verse and try to really understand this book. The way that most of us encounter it is if we're going to do something like a read through the Bible in a year, that kind of thing. And so you start in Genesis, which is very animated and fun and good reading. And then Exodus, and the first half of Exodus is really good. But then you get into law and instruction for the tabernacle and things kind of slow down. And you're thinking maybe Leviticus will be better, but then Leviticus is worse. And it's just 27 chapters of more laws. And then you're thinking, surely that's the end. But then you get to Numbers. And Numbers, it isn't law necessarily. There's some law, but it's like a lot of numbers. And then you get to Deuteronomy, and it's more law. So by the time you get to Deuteronomy, most of us are pretty tired of reading law. And so that's how we think of it. We think of this as just a bunch of laws. But Deuteronomy is preparing Israel. It's a set of speeches by Moses to Israel as they have been through the wilderness for 40 years, and they're about to cross into the promised land. And so Moses is reminding them of what happened in the wilderness, and he's reminding them of the law. And he's doing it in a way that's preparing them to be an urban people rather than a wilderness people. And so some of this has to do with how are they going to take the lessons they learned in the wilderness and apply them in a new context. But also part of it is you've never had to deal with before, and now you're going to have to deal with that. Second, Deuteronomy does not prescribe life in Babylon or in the church. So you take an Israelite city like Hazor. Hazor is just an Israelite city. Hazor is different from Babylon, or from DFW, or from Maypearl, in that Hazor is completely comprised of people who are part of the covenant people of God. Everyone who lives in Hazor is Israelite. They're all part of this covenant people. But when you live in Maypearl, not everyone is part of the covenant people. And when you live in Dallas, not everyone is part of the covenant people. And so you can't look at someone in Maypearl and say, well, but Deuteronomy says, therefore you need to do this. Well, no, this rule doesn't apply to them because they're not part of this covenant people. Does that make sense? It's just like I don't get to discipline someone else's kids unless they really trust me and have conferred on me that capacity. But I can't walk up to some stranger at Target and spank their kid, right? That's frowned upon. Because they're not part of my family. In the same way, I can't walk up to someone in Maypearl and say, but the rule says, because these are not their rules. And it's the same way for the church. Deuteronomy doesn't prescribe life for the church. Never once does the New Testament say that the Christian needs to do something because the law says they have to do it. So what is the value of this book? Why bother with Deuteronomy at all then? Deuteronomy prompts us to imagine a better city and what it would take to make that happen. It stirs in us values. It instills values in us. I think we should use Deuteronomy the way that the apostles did, which whenever the apostles talk about this book, they would always use it as a source of wisdom. I think about when Paul quotes it and says, don't muzzle the ox while he's treading out the grain. Okay, that has to do with not muzzling your ox while he's treading out grain. It doesn't have anything to do with paying your shepherds or your preachers or whoever. But Paul sees in that wisdom and he applies it to a new context. I think that's the kind of thing that the church is to do with this book. Okay. How are we doing? Are we totally... I feel like I'm just rambling. We're okay? All right. So we're tracking. So what we're going to do is go through our four pillars. What does Deuteronomy prescribe about community, about economy, industry, and government? And of course, we're not going to be able to get into any real depth here because Deuteronomy is a fascinating text. And there's too much depth. So we're just going to do the skipping a rock on a lake. We're just going to do the skimming the surface kind of thing. Community. What does Deuteronomy teach about the way that we interact with our neighbors? Because this book has a lot to say about tithing or about right worship, eating kosher. It also says things like, don't kill each other, which that has to do with community. But I think that's kind of extreme. And I don't know how many of us were tempted to kill our neighbor this last week. Maybe you were. I don't know your neighbors. But what does Deuteronomy have to say about just day in, day out life with other people? Okay. There are three areas that Deuteronomy talks about, in my estimation. And what we're really doing today is we're taking my master's thesis and trying to present it in a way that's useful for the church. And so I spent a lot of time thinking about this. And I think there are three areas where the community is sort of legislated. And those are with regard to sex, property, and debt. So without going too much into the weeds, because you can get lost here, Deuteronomy 22. Deuteronomy 22 legislates on sexual unions between partners who are not married to each other. And it makes a distinction between if this happened in a city or if this happened out in the field. If the female partner was married or if she was unmarried. If the man was married or unmarried. All of those play in, and so it has all these different circumstances. If this is the case, this is how you react. If this is the case, this is how you react. If this is two unwed people and they come together, well, the response is that they have to get married. The young man is not allowed to divorce her because he has brought shame on her and her family, and so he is going to take care of her for the rest of his life. He doesn't get to use her and then send her away. He has to provide for her for the rest of his life. And he has to pay damages to her father for bringing shame on her family. If this happened in the city, then you have to assume that she screamed for help. Or no, excuse me. If this happened in the country, you assume that she screamed for help, that it was not consensual. If this happened in the city and no one heard a scream, you assume that it was consensual. Okay, this is what Deuteronomy says. My whole point in bringing this up is to say this is an area where communal life is being legislated. Next up is property. There are basically two passages that tell one family what they can and cannot do with regard to their neighbor's property. So in chapter 19, verse 14, do not move your neighbor's boundary stones set up by your predecessors in the inheritance you receive in the land the Lord your God is giving you to possess. That is, when we move into the promised land, and we're going to divvy up all this land, all these different families, you're going to have these boundary stones that mark where your land ends and their land begins. You do not move that so that, you know, if you move it over 10 feet, well, now all of that land becomes yours. You're stealing land. Not allowed to do that. Why? Because this is the boundary marker that was set up by your ancestors. The other passage is in chapter 23, verse 24 and 25. If you enter your neighbor's vineyard, you may eat all the grapes you want, but do not put any in your basket. If you enter your neighbor's grain field, you may pick kernels with your hands, but you must not put a sickle to his standing grain. Which, this is a passage that gets really important in the life of Jesus when he has one of his disputes with the Pharisees, because his disciples are taking grain with their hand, and the Pharisees accuse them of harvesting. So you're allowed to help yourself to your neighbor's crops as you're passing through, get a little snack, but you're not allowed to harvest your neighbor's land. You can't go into your neighbor's land and start pulling off grapes and putting them into your basket and taking it back to your house. No, that's too much. And then third is debt. So if one family falls into hard times, they may want to sell their land to their neighbor. You may imagine your neighborhood. Or some of you don't live in a neighborhood. Maybe it's a long way away before you get to the next neighbor. But the people who have the land adjacent to you, just imagine them. And you fall on hard times. And so you sell your land to them. What you're really doing is selling the harvests that are going to come off of your fields to them. And at the year of release, every 7 years, the ledgers are cleared, everything is reset, your land becomes your land again, the debt goes away. It's a jubilee. Every 7 years this happens. The hope is that through this control of debt, no one comes to control the whole city. You don't want any one family to have a monopoly on everything. The idea is that there would be no such thing as generational poverty, and there would be no such thing as monopoly. What we see in all three of these is that stability of the family land is really important, because it's a gift from God, it's a gift from Yahweh. In all three of these areas, the main concern is to keep the family land in the family. So with illicit sexual unions, the whole point is you don't want to have an heir that is produced who would have some sort of claim that messes with who gets what land. Does that make sense? If you have a man that has an affair with a married woman and she becomes pregnant by this other man, who gets to have the land from the resulting child? Does that child inherit his biological father's land? You see how this can get kind of messy. That's the whole point. That's why there are such tight regulations on it. Same thing with the laws about property and with debt. Stability of the family land is important. I think what this is cultivating in us, if we can internalize everything Deuteronomy says, and I don't know. If we can internalize it, what we're learning is that this urban society that Deuteronomy imagines is characterized by trust, benevolence, hospitality, and respect. It's imagining a city where everybody treats everybody else with trust, with generosity, with hospitality, and respect. No one is taking advantage of anybody else's property. As you're going through my land, you're welcome to help yourself to a handful of grain, or two. Thanks, Jerry. Don't worry about it. I'm not going to put a sickle to your land. I'm not going to take advantage of your hospitality. And so there's a mutuality about it. And Jerry, if you're ever on my land, you help yourself too. There's a mutual trust, generosity, hospitality, and respect. That's what makes this work, right? Okay, any thoughts or questions on community?
In the book of Ruth, there's a lesson there as far as working out of the details of that. Boaz is diligent to allow those who do not have to come onto the land and glean behind his reapers.
Mm-hmm.
This is a great illustration of what Moses is talking about here.
Yeah. Yeah, Ruth, what he was referring to is Ruth and, not Boaz, Ruth and Naomi. Actually, no, Naomi stays home. It's just Ruth who goes out into the field and is allowed to glean behind the harvesters. So whatever food they drop on the ground, she's allowed to scoop up and put into the folds of her dress and take home. And she brings home a ton. Actually, I think, I could be wrong, but I think Boaz actually loads her up at the end of the day. And to make sure that she has plenty.
Actually, Boaz is going the second mile here. He didn't. He wasn't required to do that, you know, under these regulations, but he did.
Yeah. But Ruth is a fascinating story. And Boaz.
He told him to leave enough stuff that she would have sufficient.
Yeah, yeah. He told. So. Yes, it's a great example. Great example of this. Okay, so let's talk about economy. You remember, when we talk about economy, what we're dealing with is surplus food. Because a city, to have a city, you have multiple families who band together, and they're like, hey guys, we're gonna work together, and I'm gonna take, you know, we're gonna harvest our land, you harvest your land, and we'll keep whatever we need to survive, and whatever is left over, whatever surplus there is, we'll put into a common pot. And then if one of us has a bad harvest or something, we can help ourselves and we'll all kind of, we'll work together with this. The question is, what happens with that surplus? Well, it has to be managed. It has to be, especially when it becomes too big, you want to make sure nobody's taking advantage of it and so on. You need someone keeping track of who put in how much and all this. Well, this is the makings of an economy. I have more than I need to survive, so what do I do with the rest? That's the question that we're wanting to know. What does Deuteronomy say we do with the rest? Do we save it? Do we buy clothes? Do we invest it? Do we buy school supplies? How do we engage with the market? And what's interesting to me is that Deuteronomy has very little to say about the market. I would expect it to have a lot to say about the market, but it really doesn't. When Deuteronomy talks about that surplus, the thing it talks about the most is the tithe. The tithe. The tithe functions as Israel's tax. So there are two places where this is mentioned. One is in chapter 14. The other is all of chapter 26, but we're not going to do that. But chapter 14, beginning in verse 22. Be sure to set aside a tenth of all that your fields produce each year. Eat the tithe of your grain, new wine, and oil, and the firstborn of your herds and flocks in the presence of the Lord your God at the place that he will choose as a dwelling for his name, so that you may learn to revere the Lord your God always. But if that place is too distant, and you've been blessed by the Lord your God, and you cannot carry your tithe because the place the Lord your God will choose to put his name is so far away, then exchange your tithe for silver and take the silver with you and go to the place the Lord your God will choose. Use the silver to buy whatever you like, cattle, sheep, wine, or other fermented drink, and anything you wish. Then you and your household shall eat there in the presence of the Lord your God and rejoice. And do not neglect the Levites living in your towns, for they have no allotment or inheritance of their own. Okay. And then there's more detail in chapter 26. The idea is every year you produce, again, I have no concept of a bushel, but let's just say you've produced 100 bushels of wheat and you only need, well, actually, it doesn't really matter how much you need. You're going to take 10 bushels. And that's your tithe. You're going to give that to the common pot. You're going to take that to the temple in Jerusalem. You're going to put that in the common granary. And you're going to have a party. And you're going to take the firstborn from your cow and the firstborn from your goat. And you're going to bring them to the temple. And you're going to take the first of everything, one-tenth of everything that you have, that you produce that year. And you're going to have a feast. And you're going to invite the Levite that lives in your town. He gets to come with you and your family. And any widows or fatherless kids, they're going to come with you. And you're going to make the journey, if it's close enough, to Jerusalem. And you're going to have one great meal where you're eating off of the tithe. But you're not going to finish the whole tithe. If you produce 10 bushels of wheat, you're not going to eat 10 bushels in one sitting. But you're helping yourself out of it, and then what's left is stored for the Levite to live off of, because he doesn't have a field. So that's going to be there for him to survive off of. The widow will be able to help herself to that, the fatherless child. When the poor who fall into hard times and are not able to harvest, or they've had to sell their land or whatever. This is Israel's tax. As far as I can tell, the Hebrew language doesn't have a word for tax. It learns a word when it goes into exile. And so there is a word for tax that appears in the Old Testament, but it's all in books that are written after the exile. Before the exile, they don't have a word for tax. I think the tithe takes the place of it. Surplus food is possible because of the mutual faithfulness of God and his people. If Israel is faithless, if they abandon the covenant and they don't do everything they're supposed to do and they're violating all these laws, what's going to happen? Are they going to have lots of rain and lots of food? No. God says, if you violate this, I'm not going to send rain. If Israel is faithless, he will be faithful to what he said, and there will be no food. If Israel is faithful, God will also be faithful, and there will be plenty. Surplus food is possible when both Israel and Yahweh are faithful. What we see also is that the tithe is being brought and relinquished willingly. It's not brought by coercion. You don't have to have some IRS agent that comes knocking on your door saying, pay up or else. Instead, you come to the central granary or the temple and you bring your 10 bushels and your goat because of the thankfulness that you actually feel for what God has done for you that year. And it's hard for us to imagine parting with a tenth of everything that we've produced gladly. But you know what? God loves a cheerful giver, doesn't he? I think that's what that text is about. So Deuteronomy imagines a city where you don't need coercion. You don't need somebody with a sword or a badge telling you you have to pay up. Because you want to, because you're thankful and you're content with the 90%. And then the tithe exists to support the vulnerable, not to support the powerful or to build public infrastructure. When we think of tax, we're thinking of, well, we're paying into a common pot that then gets used to pay for military or roads or any number of things. Salaries of public servants and so on. That's not what the tithe functions for in Deuteronomy. It is there to provide for people who cannot provide for themselves. It's there to make sure that the widow and the fatherless and the Levite have something to eat. So where does the infrastructure come from? Deuteronomy doesn't say. Deuteronomy assumes the infrastructure. Okay, thoughts on economy? Or questions?
Eventually the infrastructure would come with the king. When you had that, they were the ones who began it.
Yeah, especially Solomon. What we see in the life of King Solomon is a huge infrastructure. It's almost like the New Deal. I think that's a reasonable comparison. He builds cities out of thin air. He builds entire cities. He converts cities into administrative centers. That's not just in the text. That's archaeologically. You can go and see, oh, this town was relatively sparse, and then all of a sudden we can detect this very organized city plan this was done by somebody at the top. This wasn't done kind of hop-knock together.
When the people clamored for a king, Samuel told them exactly what was going to happen, that they were going to be taxed and taxed heavily to do the bidding of the king.
And what is it that eventually caused the nation to fracture? It was essentially the tax. And again, they don't have a word for tax to say that, but they have been, they've had their wealth extracted from them to the point that they are not surviving, and they come to the king and say, "You've got to loosen the reins on us." And the king, that Solomon's son, says, "No, no, my father scourged you with whips, I will scourge you with scorpions. I'm going to raise taxes," which is not a good campaign promise. And so there's a coup and civil war. Okay, I don't have a whole lot to say about industry, but when we say industry, again, what we're talking about is any job that's not food production. Anything that's not farming or ranching is specialization of labor. And in order to have a city, you have to have at least one person who has a job where they're not farming. So what does Deuteronomy have to say about occupations other than farming? And the answer is, not much. Food production is the dominant industry in Deuteronomy. And I think that that's intentional. The prophet Micah has this vision that in the last days, the city of Jerusalem would be, the Mount Zion would be the highest of all the mountains, and all the nations would come to it and say, "Come on, let's go up to Zion and learn the law." And they'll beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Isaiah has a similar poem, but Micah says that every man will be under his own fig tree. Everyone will have their own little farm. This is the ideal. This kind of self-sustaining but also communal environment. And so it's no surprise to me that Deuteronomy would have the same vision.
Don't you think that was because that's the fundamental, and then their whole economy was based on food production. Their tithe was in terms of food production. Survival was important.
Yeah. I mean, what does it take to get past food production being the main thing?
Well, or
abundance. An abundance of food, an ability to harvest it, and to grow more than you need. You think about a farmer today who's got, you know, thousands of acres of wheat that he's growing, or thousands of acres of corn. There's no way that one family could have managed a parcel that size in antiquity. And so you have to be able to get to where you're producing enough to feed hundreds of families from each farmer. I don't even remember what question I'm responding to at this point, or what if there was one. Anyway, yeah, food production has to be the dominant thing in antiquity because of the technology that's available to them. The primary specializations that we do see are the priests and the government. And we're going to talk about the government next. But the priests are, as far as I can tell, the only profession that somebody has in Deuteronomy other than farming or ranching, shepherding. All right, government. We could do an entire Sunday school series just on the role of government in Deuteronomy, because it is complex. But allow me instead to just make a few comments. In our own culture, we have multiple levels of authority, don't we? You have, what's a child's first level of authority? I would say it's actually not the parents. I would say it's the teacher, if they're at a school age. Because the parents trump the teacher, don't they? If it comes down to it and the two disagree, parents win. And then there's actually someone who can come in above the parents and say, no, you can't do that to your child. There, so you have like municipal government, you have county government, you have state government, you have federal government, you have international government. Or, I don't know what you would call that, thinking of like Interpol or the UN or something. But you have multiple levels. It's the same way in Deuteronomy. You have multiple levels of authority. So the sort of the bottom layer that we would call government are the local elders. Or as we learned the term last week, the old ones. The heads of households, the fathers of the town, who, because they've lived the longest, they carry a certain clout and authority. And if there's some dispute in the town, they know the Ten Commandments, and they know all of the commands that sort of fit inside each of those baskets. And so they're able to make a judgment and lead the town. But a time will come in Deuteronomy 17:18, it says in Deuteronomy chapter 16, verse 18, appoint judges and officials for each of your tribes in every town that the Lord your God is giving you, and they shall judge the people fairly. Don't pervert justice or show partiality. Don't accept a bribe. And so you're going to appoint judges. These judges are of a higher authority than the elders are. There's a story in, must be in 2 Kings, about King Jehoshaphat. It's a mouthful of a name. Jehoshaphat appoints judges himself. He doesn't allow the towns to do it. He appoints judges. And one of the prophets indicts him for that because they're in the pocket of the empire. They give whatever judgment Jehoshaphat would want them to give. They're his cronies. They're not fair. They're not impartial. And so the prophets rail on Jehoshaphat. So you have elders, you have local judges, and then you have what I call the central court. I don't know that Deuteronomy ever uses that term. But in chapter 17, verse 8, if cases come before your courts that are too difficult for you to judge, bloodshed, lawsuits, or assaults, take them to the place that the Lord your God will choose. Go to Jerusalem. Go to the priests who are Levites and to the judge who is in office at that time. Inquire of them and they will give you the verdict. So this is not a court of appeal. This isn't like if you lose your case, then you can go up the food chain to the next layer of court. This is if you're a judge and something is too complex, you don't know what the right thing is here, then you go to the central court. And there's a judge there who will make the decision for you. It's kind of like a Moses figure. You go to him. It's the Romans called it a juris consultus. You go and get a second opinion. And then above the central court, eventually, someday, you may have a king. When you enter the land that the Lord your God is giving you, and you've taken possession of it, and you're settled in it, and you say, let's set a king over us, then here are all of the rules that govern the king. And one of the things the king is supposed to do is read the Bible over and over and over. All day, every day, read the Bible. Because his job will be to digest it, interpret it, and enforce Torah. He doesn't get to make new rules. He doesn't get to write legislation. He's not a legislative branch of government. He is a judicial branch. He's the Supreme Court. And then above the king is Torah. Torah is the highest authority in the city, even over the king. I think about King David. You guys remember the story where he'd had an affair with Bathsheba. And then the prophet Nathan comes to him and says, there was a man who had many sheep, and his neighbor only had one sheep. And he went to his neighbor and took his neighbor's sheep and used it to feed his guests. And what does David say? Do you remember? He says he has to repay him. He thinks that this is a real court case that he's hearing, that he is now having to act as judge. And he says, this man is guilty and he has to repay four times over what he stole, which is, he's obviously been reading Deuteronomy, because that's what you do if you get caught stealing. You repay four times over. And then what does Nathan say to him? You are the man. You're the one who stole from your neighbor. The king is subject to Torah. That is unheard of in the ancient world, that the king would be subject to the law. The king is the law in the ancient world. The role of government is not to create law, but to interpret it and apply it. Ultimately, all authority comes from Yahweh in the city. And so governing figures, if they're not in right relationship with him, they don't have any authority. This is what the prophets are doing when they're indicting Jehoshaphat and the judges that he appointed himself. If they are not doing what Yahweh wants, then they have no genuine authority. Their authority doesn't come from their office. It comes from being right with God. And then the whole city is the executive branch. You'll find all these passages. I'm sure I can find one real quick. Chapter 18, 19, 20. Where's the one I'm looking for? Okay, chapter 21, verse 20. They shall say to the elders, the parents of a young man will say, this son of ours is stubborn and rebellious. He won't obey us. He's a profligate. Profligate and a drunkard. Then all the men of his town shall stone him to death. You must purge the evil from among you, and all Israel will hear and be afraid. Okay, the judges are not the ones. The elders are not the ones who cast the stones to put the man to death. The whole city does. The community is self-regulative. They don't have a military. They don't have a police force. They handle things in-house, as it were. Okay, one last thing. What would it take? Because everything that we've been talking about hardly sounds like Maypearl, doesn't it? But, and Deuteronomy is not meant to prescribe life for Maypearl, but it is holding out an ideal for a better city. And if Maypearl were going to become a better city, a more godly city, a more Deuteronomy-like kind of city, what would it take for us to get from here to there? A few things. One is you would need a community that trusts and respects each other. You would need a community where I can trust that when my neighbor is crossing through the land, he's not taking advantage of me. And you need a community where my neighbor isn't taking advantage of me. He respects me. I respect him. He respects me. I trust him. He trusts me. Is that the world that we live in? No. But that's one thing that would have to happen for us to have the city of God, to live in the city of God. You would need a deep sense of contentment and gratitude. If we live with a chronic discontent, then we're always needing to expand. We're always in competition. The market value of your house can go through the roof because everybody wants, because of competition. But if everybody in our city were able to live with contentment and gratitude, that would be a step toward being able to live like this. We would need for everyone in the city to recognize that Yahweh is the ultimate authority. That would be a colossal step. And if I could make that step in my own life, that would be a colossal step. But if the city were filled from top to bottom with people whose ultimate allegiance is not to the city of Maypearl or to the state of Texas or to the United States, but their ultimate allegiance was to Yahweh and his kingdom. And not just to this vague God, but to the God of the Bible. That would be a huge step toward the city like this. If we could get past a city where, what am I trying to say? We think that we're a Christian nation because in the Declaration of Independence, we've said that man is endowed by his creator with certain inalienable rights. And there's all this talk of God. But there is nowhere that talks about Jesus, resurrection, Moses, any of the articles of Christian faith. It's just this vague philosophical idea of a God. But if we could recognize the God of the Bible, the Father of Jesus Christ who fills us with the Spirit as the ultimate authority, whoo, that'd be a big step toward becoming a city of God. To put it simply, if our city could learn to love God and love our neighbor, we would be a city of God.